And I think we're live, or we should be going live any moment. If there's anybody in the chat can give me a one, and I think we'll get up and running. This is always here we are once again. Well, welcome in everybody, welcome in everybody. Put the troubles away. We're going to get into we recently lost the great David Lynch, and I thought we should cover one of his films, but not one of the headbuster ones, because it's just too arduous and everybody will have their own takes. And I thought we'll go into he did some straight movies as well. And this is one of them. There he I mean just a little note on David Lynch before we get into it, because I do think he was like I've noticed that a lot of the people on our side of things like love David Lynch movies, and I can see why. He's most famous for there's a quite a bit, like Blue Velvet. He did. If you go back, it was Eraserhead, which Elephant Man, which we're going to talk about, looks quite like Eraserhead, the black and white kind of and the industrial sort of aesthetic, which we'll get into. And then he did, as far as I can remember, then it was Elephant Man in 1980, and then June in 1984, which I think is great. It gets a hard time off film buffs, but I prefer to the new one. It's not like I hate it on the new one either. But even though like the Zendaya thing and all that, I mean, anyway, I didn't hate the new one, but I do like the David Lynch Dune. I think it's good, especially there's like a 3 hour one, and then his movies began to get more and more surreal. He was into sort of transcendental meditation, and you get into there's Mulholland Drive is the famous one. There's Lost Highway. There's What is it? Wild at Heart with Nicolas Cage, which is also they're all great. And then later there's the Inland Empire, and I've watched them all. I even watched Inland Empire, which was like 3 hours long of just watching Laura Dern like go through hell and back. And I think the issue is that you just haven't got a clue what's going on in these films. I didn't anyway. And you've just got to kind of get the vibe, and you've just got to go with it. And I think Twin Peaks as well, which was a TV show, is another thing that kind of people get at. And I think there's a lot of right-wing kind of coded elements in there as well, which at first you think he like if something like Mulholland Drive has got it's all to do with Hollywood and the corruption of Hollywood, and it's kind of ethnically aware, if you get what I mean. And the same goes for something like Blue Velvet. There's a lot of themes in Blue Velvet, and it's as if he's trying to say that small town America, which he loved, was under attack, or it was rotten underneath. But it was as if it was kind of as if it wasn't their fault, and that the rot was coming in from somewhere else. And then he also did a one called Straight Story, which was just about a man driving across, I think, like three or four states on an old lawnmower to visit a dying relative or something like that. And again, it was this real kind of celebration of unashamedly of Americana. So there's a lot of good in David Lynch, even though he gets into some very, very dark territory. Like it's some of the more surreal things are genuinely horrifying in parts, especially Inland Empire. I found a bit of a struggle, but whatever. The fact is, we've lost them. It was a shame. I think it was connected to the fires that they had in LA. He was in poor condition because he'd been a heavy smoker for all his life, and I think they moved him from the fires. And his health deteriorated because he went somewhere else to live. I suppose he was living there, not just because he was a Hollywood sort of legend, but because of the good weather. And at any rate, that was it. That's we've lost David Lynch, one of the most fascinating directors of modern times, and a genuine kind of, I'd say he's borderline our guy as well. But today, rest in peace, David Lynch. And there's a lot of good stuff out there to explore, which you're not going to see these days. Even his Dune was so much deeper and kind of fleshed out. You felt the metaphysical aspects to it, which you just didn't in De Villeneuve's, which was fantastic in parts. I mean, I loved the worm ride in the new Dune, but there's something a kind of magic to David Lynch's Dune, which is, it's got that surreal element in, and it's quite gross in parts. And I think it just resonates. It just feels more like the book. But of course, today everybody's about spectacle. Everybody's in grand vistas rather than kind of getting into the heart and soul of things. But yeah, that's me little intro on David Lynch. So rest in peace, David Lynch. He did some great stuff. And I haven't even introduced Endeavor. Welcome again, Endeavor.
Thank you for having me. And I must confess that this is actually the first time I've ever seen any of David Lynch's movies. So I think you covered it at the beginning. I didn't really have much to add. So, but you know, I'm glad to be here, and we have a somewhat interesting movie to cover tonight. Interesting drama, some interesting moral dilemmas presented in the movie. I had heard of this movie many years ago, but I never got around to actually watching it. I had heard a bit about the historical figure of John Merrick, whose real name was actually Joseph Merrick. But this was my first time with this movie. So, I do have a bit to say about the moral aspects of the movie. But overall, it is an interesting drama, and it's well shot. And anything with Anthony Hopkins is probably going to be good. So yeah, we'll get into that.
I mean, you do see the kind of the Lynchian aspects are here, though more subdued. So like I said, you had Eraserhead, I think that was 1977, which was much more kind of a hardcore surrealist. It was quite horrible in parts, but it had that kind of sparse black and white palette that he's using again here in The Elephant Man. And another thing which we'll probably come on to is that in The Elephant Man, there's this sort of mixture. You get it in a lot of David Lynch films where it's more like it's just the overall experience. So one of the things that you'll notice in The Elephant Man throughout is that it has this kind of industrial ambient noise to it. It's as if he's like got a microphone on the side of pipes running through the hospital, so you can hear or feel like the water running through pipes. And again and again and again, you see these kind of, the camera just lingers on people bashing steel or pistons and steam coming out of vent ways and all of this kind of thing. And so you get this, and then on top of that, it's just in the landscape itself is very harsh and very, it's a much grimmer look of Victorian England than what we're used to. I mean, the last film that we did was Charles Dickens' Scrooge, which is set in a similar era to this. That's in Victorian London as well. But you can see that it's a much more enchanted, much more kind of cozy than Victorian England in The Elephant Man, which looks horrible, to be quite honest. It just looks the most grimmest, depressing place you can imagine. And so you get these Lynchian elements in there, which we can come on to again. I'm going to assume that most people know the story, but I'll go through it anyway. So as Endeavor says, he wasn't actually called John Merrick. He was called Joseph Merrick. And I don't want to get too kind of bogged down in sort of his real life, which is similar. Obviously it's based on his life story, and it's also based on a piece, like a thought piece, on meditations on empathy, which I know we're going to talk about that as well. And so he is horribly deformed, and to the point where he's just can't fit into society. Everybody who looks at him are just mortified by it. And he's treated horribly as well. And he's got this kind of grifting wide boy scumbag who acts as his slave master, who rents him out and earns money from using him as an exhibition. And Anthony Hopkins stumbles across the freak show and has a look, and then he finds him. And from his perspective, it's a scientific curiosity, whereas for the plebs, it's just this kind of horrible freak show to be laughed at and abused. And so he takes him under his wing. He takes him into the hospital. And there's a big turning point in the film, which I think a lot of people miss. And it's that this is also like a Lynchian thing. David Lynch is all about the eyes, and he's obsessed with the sort of subject and objective ideas of being watched or being the watcher, and this kind of voyeuristic sort of cinematography. And so obviously in The Elephant Man, there's that going on from all sides, but all centered around Merrick, because he is somebody who is being watched like all the time and horrifying people as they do it. And a crucial moment, I find, comes in when he gets into the hospital. At this point, we haven't heard him speak. In fact, we don't even know if he can speak. And Anthony Hopkins makes this quip that when he leaves the first time, he says he hopes he's an idiot. He hopes that the person who is under that deformity, that degree of kind of being grotesqueness, if that's a word, he hopes that he's an imbecile so that he can't compute just how miserable his life is. But then shortly after that, there's a scene where John Gielgud comes in, who's the boss of the hospital where they are. And we discover that not only can he speak, but that he's actually highly educated, and he can read and he can recite the Bible. And so this changes the whole dynamic of the film, but it also changes the actual way the film is shot, because from then on, John Merrick changes from being an object to a subject. So we then afterwards, until the end of the film, we see things from his perspective, because it's like, actually, yeah, there is a sentient person in here. Of course, one of the famous lines, which comes later, is that I'm not an animal. I'm a man. I'm a human being. When he screams it out in the train station, because what happens is the scumbags come back. The masses, the plebs, they come back and they taunt him, and then eventually he gets abducted and taken to Belgium to be in a freak show, which turns out again to be a thoroughly miserable, abusive situation. He gets out of that. He comes back to London, where he's abused once again by the stinking plebs. And then finally he's accepted into high society. And he becomes sort of, in a way, normalized. I mean, there's a lot to this. I'm skipping over it quickly. And then he decides that he's finally going to rest himself and let himself die. So I actually tried not. I watched this film when I was a youngster, and I found it absolutely horrific, but also just too much, just too miserable of a film. My impression of it was that it just wallowed in misery, which I think it does, to be quite honest. But at this, and I didn't go back to it because I thought this is just such a bad time. And having watched it again, I do think that is the case. I do think it's a very, very sad, disturbing film because it raises questions about human empathy and that kind of thing. And I think, well, what do you, have you got anything to add to that?
Well, I guess on the theme of human empathy, with the character of John Merrick or Joseph Merrick, we'll just call him John since that's what he was called in the movie. With the character of John Merrick, you can't help but just feel horrible for him because just imagining, you know, having to live your life as, well, somebody that everyone views as a monster, everyone just views them as a freak. He's literally being put in the freak show because that was his only viable way of actually making money. It was like the only thing he could do in that society. There was even I did read a bit about the guy today before the stream, and one thing I heard was that a lot of the hosts of these freak shows at the time, they were worried that he was going to be too disturbing to put in the show. So they were worried that, like, this show, which is meant to be disturbing, meant to freak people out, they thought that this guy would just, like, make people scream and run in terror. And, you know, you can't help but feel horrible for the guy. However, you know, it's a hard moral question to answer. Like, what do you actually do with someone like John Merrick? I mean, how can he fit into society? It's very hard to answer. One of the themes of the movie is it's the theme of like, you know, the misfit, the theme of the freak. And it could just be like there's also kind of the theme of prejudice and of judging the book by its cover, because as you learn later in the movie that John Merrick is actually, I don't know if he's a genius per se, but he actually has the intellect of an ordinary man. He's capable of understanding religion, the Bible. He's capable of reading poetry and reading Shakespeare. So, you know, there actually is a man there, but his external appearance is quite horrific. You know, one of the messages which we're brought up with today is from kindergarten is that don't judge by external appearance. So the external presentation of someone is not actually what matters. It's what's on the inside. And this is actually, I think, a very damaging message that we're fed today. It's something which I think is just patently untrue. Because, you know, there's a reason why we have our instincts. There's a reason why, you know, humans react in a certain way when they see danger. And I think that that's actually just natural and healthy. And it's used in a political way today, which we can get into a bit later. But I think people kind of know what I'm alluding to. It's the idea that this idea of not judging, that there's the adage, you know, don't judge a book by its cover. And I've always thought that was kind of a stupid adage because books have covers so that you can judge them before you read them. But anyway, like, and then, you know, you can learn a lot about people by their appearance. You know, physiognomy, I think, tells you a lot about a person. And then the real subversive thing about this kind of message is that what it's been used to do in the present day, and I don't want to get too bogged down in present day politics, but I think it's related here, though. What it's done in the present day is that it's subverted our natural and healthy fear of the unknown and fear of the outsider and fear of that which is not normal to us. And that's a very subversive message because this is how, you know, you get things like the example from the past couple of months is that there's that Southport killer. And you see that picture which they're releasing on social media and it's absolutely ghastly. You want to scream in horror when you see a picture like that. And, well, you know, that actually reflects reality. It's because this is like a horrific figure, and it's someone who you rightfully should be afraid of and you should rightfully not want in your community at all. However, you know, bring that back to the movie. The reason this is something which I feel is like a very damaging message today. When I'm trying to apply that to the Elephant Man, I do feel the sympathy, though. I do feel sympathy for him because, you know, he's not, it's a medical condition that which has done that to him. And I know that, you know, I don't want to say that you can't judge people on things that aren't their choice, because, you know, someone being part of your in-group or out-group, that's not a choice. That's not a conscious choice that they make. But I still think it is something that you can make judgment on. But with him, it's a medical condition. So he has a very sorry state which he's in. And I guess what I would say is that I don't feel that the people who scream when they see John Merrick, I don't feel like it's amoral to react that way. I think that is just the natural reaction. And I think that it is just I think that's actually just kind of healthy to feel that way when you're confronted with something which your instincts tell you is dangerous. However, as we learn through the movie, that he actually is a decent guy, and from what I know, the actual historical John Merrick turned out to be quite a likable guy. I mean, I can't blame any woman in the world for not wanting to accept his hand in marriage or anything like that. But people eventually did kind of come around to him. Now, I think it is also the novelty, because the film kind of does get into this a bit, that the question is brought up later, like, are the upper classes who are going to meet with John Merrick? So Anthony Hopkins' character, Frederick Treves, I believe was his name. Is he any better than the guy running the sideshow? Because, all these upper class people are now coming to see John Merrick just because of the novelty of seeing this like horribly deformed man. But you can see that it is better for him, because at least he actually has some kind of human relationships now. People actually want to be his friend, which, you know, for whatever reason, I think that's better than before. So it brings up these moral questions, because I do think that the overall arching message of not judging a book by its cover, I disagree with that. I think that's a very damaging message today. However, with the figure of John Merrick, it does also kind of bring back that moral question, because in the case, I do feel horrible for the guy. You do feel like you want to give him sympathy, even though his appearance really is horrifying.
I mean, the path that he goes on is interesting. Now, the thing about what happens in the way that Lynch shoots this is kind of rare these days, because it's the working class of Victorian England who are depicted just as absolute scum. Like, there's no two ways about it, that in this reading of it, what he seems to be trying to say is that actually it's I don't think he's coming at it from a kind of lefty Marxist way or like a shit lib way. I think he's coming at it from a kind of elitist perspective, and what he's saying is, like, all of you ugly kind of dumb plebs, you can't read, you're all vindictive, petty-minded little grifting rats, you deserve it, all of you, like, poor working class people, you're all filth and idiots and scum. Which is kind of, from today's perspective, it's strange, especially when you see, like, where the direction this goes in with the elites. But Lynch has gone further than that as well, because there's a part in it when Michael Elphick, I mean, people of a certain age in the chat may remember Boone. Nobody seems to remember Boone except me. But it was a series, Hi Ho Silver and all of that in the late 80s. Anyway, Michael Elphick, he gets the people from the pub to come around. I wonder where the security was. Like, they put Merrick into this nice private hospital, in his own room and everything. And there just doesn't seem to be anybody there to hold them back. You've got all these drunken scruffs kind of throwing things at him and pouring, you know, there's women there laughing at him and everything. And what I think is funny is that when you actually look at the way it's shot, there's a shot where there's one man and he is ugly in his own right, and he's got his arms around a couple of trollops, and he's laughing and he's saying, "I told you he was grotesque. I told you you would want to be sick when you saw him." But by this time, we've become used to seeing Merrick. It isn't a shock to us as the viewers anymore, but what's shocking to us are these people. And it's as if he's saying, like, you are the true beasts here, you are the true monsters. And he's shot it, he shot them in the most unflattering way you can possibly imagine. So, and that's what you walk away with deliberately. And another layer, which a couple of good YouTube video essays have picked this up, and it gets back to what I was saying about Lynch and the subject and the object, and it's that where, so you get this weird setup. So you've got all the scruffs and the plebs from the pub are laughing and jeering and taunting Merrick, but we are watching them watch him, and it's kind of like they are to us as the modern, you know, empathetic, more liberal viewer than what he is to them. And so it's as if Lynch has reframed it to make them the monsters and them the freaks, which is a clever and accurate way of doing it. And I do think that in reality, in Victorian England, that is probably how people would have treated them as well, unfortunately. I've worked with lads who are ugly who got called John Merrick, like just straight to their faces, you know. Like it is an element. We don't like to dwell on it very much these days because we like to do this kind of all white solidarity and all of this kind of thing. But the fact is, there's a lot of people out there who are white and who are like vindictive pieces of shit. But what happens then is the Anne Bancroft character comes in, who's in the opera house. She's part of high society. She's a socialite. She's got a lot of clout. She's got a lot of influence. And you'll notice that she arrives and she says, like, she doesn't flinch. Like, she comes, I think she's the only person in the whole film. She enters Merrick's room, and she doesn't bat an eye. She just doesn't care. And she's perfectly fine with it. And she brings him a photo or an etching or whatever it is. And then it brings him some books to read. And all of a sudden you realize that he has the establishment. He has the higher classes are warming to him. And she's going to introduce him. That's actually throughout the movie as well. Like when Bites, I think he's called, which is an interesting name, and he is the one that kind of puts him on show. Another kind of unshaven, kind of greasy looking Torag from the lower orders. And he arrives at the hospital to take him back, and he's threatening Anthony Hopkins to say, like, look, I'm going to get that's my man in there. I'm going to take him back. And you're standing in the way. I'm going to go to the authorities. And then John Gielgud comes, who's the administrator of the whole hospital, very influential man. And he's like, go to the authorities then. Go on. Go and see what happens. You go to the authorities and tell them about us and just watch. And what's implied there is like, know your place, you pleb. We are taking care of Merrick now, and you're on the outs. And it's rare because what we see is this, the elite and in the institutions are actually more benevolent than the actual masses. They're like, and I was thinking, like, wouldn't it be nice to have elites who are genuinely good like that? But here, this gets onto what you're trying to say. And it's like, yeah, but they begin to virtue signal. And they begin. You can easily see that they then take the establishment will. In this way, it is benevolent. In this way, it's not that bad. But if the establishment, with all of their wealth and power, begin to side with the weird and the different against their own base, you're lining up for a lot of troubles, of course, which is kind of like how we arrived where we are here. But here you can see it framed as a kind of Christian charity. And if, I feel like we've had this discussion again as well, because, okay, but, I mean, they say it explicitly. You know, they get a little letter from Queen Victoria, no less. Like, Merrick is being watched over by very, very powerful people, and it's being done in the guise of Christian charity. So you, once again, we get this fine line between Christian charity and libtardism.
Yeah, so I actually do think that that would probably be believable, that in Victorian England, I would imagine that the upper classes would probably have had a lot more sympathy for John Merrick than than the working classes would. And, you know, it's probably like that today as well. You know, do you think that, some upper class lawyer is going to be more of a gentle person, or some, you know, rough and tumble construction worker who hasn't been raised up to, you know, fit into polite society in the same way? I do think that is probably genuine. That is probably accurate. And from what I know from John Merrick's story, it actually was, you know, the manager of his sideshow. The manager of the freak show. It was his father and the workhouse managers and stuff like that. And then people just who saw him on the street, those were the ones who really were cruel to him. It was actually a higher society who kind of took him in and was actually quite benevolent. So I actually do believe that I mean, I'm not saying that I think that the working class are all these horrible scum or anything like that. I certainly don't believe that. But I would say that they're probably a lot less gentle. And I think that just kind of bears itself out. But, you know, and I don't say this as an attack on David Lynch. I don't know enough about the guy, but I did kind of find the message a bit mid-witted, if you know what I mean, that the position of the plebs, of the low IQ, the left side of the bell curve, is that he's ugly, he's an abomination, he's horrible, he's disgusting, and get rid of him, and or laugh at him and jeer at him. And then the middle of the bell curve is, and again, I don't say this to as an attack on the figure of Frederick Treves, because from what I know about the figure himself, I did a bit of reading on him today. He actually was an extremely impressive man in his life. But the midwit position is, oh no, there's a man inside, and well, you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, and well, don't judge by externalities and stuff like that. Now, in the case of John Merrick, I do think that that is correct, because I mean, he's not a threat to society or anything. He's horribly sick, like as sick as an ill individual with a horrible disorder, and he's not going to wreck society or anything like that. I mean, they aren't like putting him in a beauty contest or anything like that. So I mean, that would be actually subversive, but they're just kind of like, you know, let's be kind to him, because, well, he must have just lived this miserable existence, and the least we can do is just to show him a bit of benevolence. But then when you take that idea to when you kind of blur that line, that kind of Christian benevolence, and then you blur that into libtardism, and I'm not here saying that I'm not trying to get into this whole like Christianity stuff, and like that always goes on here. I'm not interested in that. But what I mean is, I'm not going to get into this whole thing about like libtardism is Christianity, because I don't think that's true. But anyway, maybe like the right side of the bell curve would be, you know, this kind of excessive empathy towards the outgroup, towards the other, towards the outcast is actually dangerous, because that is what has happened in our society and over the past few decades. So, you know, because you could apply something like a figure like John Merrick, who, again, I will say I actually do have sympathy for him, but you know, that could be applied to something like transgenderism. So I think that it's just the natural reaction to think of let's just say to not really accept that a man pretending to be a woman is actually a woman. I think it's just natural to be horrified by that. And you know, the kind of the mid-witted position, the one that it's kind of losing steam now, but the one that we've been dominated and has dominated the media and governmental, the thing that's just dominated elite society for the past decade or so, couple decades rather, is that, well, this person actually, they need our sympathy, and that, well, this person's actually oppressed. And then what that eventually leads into is, well, they're actually morally superior to you, and this actually needs to be venerated, and this needs to be upheld as being the ideal. And well, I mean, that's an extremely destructive thing. So I give the plebs their due, I do think it is cruel to, you know, jeer at John Merrick and stuff like that. But it actually does come from an instinct which isn't all too unhealthy, I would say. So to give them their due, I do think that like the message is a bit of the midwit, because I can kind of make a more intellectualized argument for why the plebs, maybe not in the case of John Merrick himself, but why this kind of attitude overall, it's actually probably not a bad one to have.
Yeah, I mean, Ghost of Enoch in the chat says, was having sympathy for John Merrick a luxury belief of the time? And I think it became it. Now, we've got to be careful because it is just one person. And it wasn't like some kind of political campaign where everybody goes and like injects themselves with elephantitis or, you know, like that people go out and like give themselves bulbous heads and massive warts on their back. It wasn't something to be normalized. What's happened, of course, with us is that it's precisely the other way around, where it's the freak that gets or normalized and normal is pushed out onto the margins. Like, it's just become completely unhinged. And the plebs are kind of a safety mechanism against that kind of thing happening, which is exactly the dynamic of populism today, in a way. But what happens in the movie with Anne Bancroft and with Treves on the hospital, it begins with Merrick being brought to the Royal Society of Medicine and scientists, physicians. And they have him behind this screen. So from our point of view, again, with Lynch, it's all about the watching and the viewing and this kind of thing. And he's hidden behind the curtain and he's naked, but all we can see is a silhouette. And he's kind of put in a way, it's shot in a way where he looks like an alien or, you know, the creature of the Black Lagoon or something like that. But the interest is primarily at that point scientific. So you've moved it from we've taken him away from the plebs who view him as something out of a fairy tale or something, you know, because they don't understand it's a medical condition. They don't know what the hell it is. They are just like, this is an abomination and it has to be kind of cast out. Then you get into the more rational mind of the science, you know, the world of Treves, and he's a scientific curiosity. So then they're saying, well, what exactly is it? Where we are above the plebs, and we're gonna kind of look at this from a rational perspective. And then, of course, once you realize that he's actually a very intelligent man, it changes everything in the film. And when Anne Bancroft arrives, I actually believe that she is like genuinely well meant. So she's just a good person. And so the question becomes one of, which we hear about all the time today, of tolerance. What is it that you do when you've got this extreme outlier? And so Anne Bancroft's approach is actually to normalize it and make him feel welcome, make him feel as if he's just a normal man, and to take care of him. But what that does, because she's got such clout and because she's so influential, it becomes a sort of status thing where what separates the social elite scene from the plebs is their tolerance and sort of almost like admiration for John Merrick, which, again, it puts them completely at odds with the working class. But you begin to realize that there's a nurse in the hospital and she picks this up and she's saying to Treves, this is not right, because what it's allowing them to do basically is virtue signal. She doesn't use that. She doesn't say it like that, but that's what she means. So now, like, high society can virtue signal about how tolerant they are. By this point, they're all like arriving with books and having cups of tea and cakes and scones with John Merrick and engaging him with conversation. And this is what leads Treves to say, well, actually, we're back where we started. He's an exhibition all over again, except this time it's a lot more comfortable and it's a lot more, you know, it's better. It's better to be an exhibition in this way than what it is to be in the freak show again. And so what that sets in motion is the ability of it's a sort of social status to say, well, actually, I'm perfectly fine sitting and having a cup of tea with this horribly deformed man because I am enlightened and I am above these petty sort of, you know, I'm not as venal and stupid as the lower orders, which again, for Merrick, that's put him in a decent position. But that is what's happened there. As John Garris says, and the plebs act as a natural immune response. Now, when it's just one man, you think, okay, well, maybe the elites, because this is the problem, because we our like understanding of all of this is we are aware of the beliefs of the elite kind of in a society today, the bourgeois kind of middle class virtue signaling. We are aware of how that is and how catastrophic that's been for our society. But of course, they don't realize this, and it is just one man. Like, this is, as you said earlier, this is not a threat to Western civilization. The fact that, like, some posh woman goes and has a cup of tea with John Merrick, it's not really a threat to Western civilization. On the other hand, you could say, well, if you wanted to go kind of full Nietzschean sort of like might makes right and all of that, or certain hardcore political stances, they would have been like, we just need to throw him in the river and like get rid of him. Like just put him out of his misery and do it as quickly as possible and clean society of this abnormality is another way to look at it. But most of us are probably too squeamish and soft to actually do that. But it's the working class who come closest.
Oh, yeah. And what I will say is, in contrast to what I said earlier, so, you know, I did say that this idea that you should, of having too much empathy and then kind of showing too much empathy towards the anomaly. So in the case of John Merrick, it doesn't really matter because it's one man and it's just one anomaly. But of course, as we see today, when they do this with, you know, like some migrants from Africa or something like that, the actual results are absolutely disastrous. You know, one thing I thought of today is that the way that the elites in this movie, The Elephant Man, view John Merrick, that's kind of how our elites today want to view, you know, their client groups, to use a euphemism there. That's how they want their client groups to be. But as we know, that's absolutely not the case, as we've seen, you know, with something like South Park, for example. But to contrast that, though, like, because there is this problem we have today of excess empathy, that this kind of moral cause has been used to invert our own interests against ourselves, and the results have been disastrous. However, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, because I still think that empathy is a genuinely a good thing, and it's something which is, you know, unique to European civilization. And I think it's actually one of the good elements. I talked about this a bit with the Scrooge stream, which we did last month, the one on A Christmas Carol and on It's a Wonderful Life. So something like Charles Dickens is trying to instill empathy for the working classes. And I do think that that is a noble cause, because today trying to instill empathy into Europeans, even greater empathy for the outgroup, that's absolutely disastrous. But at the same time, I still want there to be empathy within society, as long as it's just actually maintained within the in-group, and it's not given to those who won't give it to you in return. So like with the example with Charles Dickens and with A Christmas Carol, I think it's a good thing that people eventually did empathize with the working classes, because in the early Industrial Revolution, the conditions really were quite horrible, and, you know, something needed to change. And, you know, kind of having that moral cause for empathizing with the working classes in that case actually did bring about a lot of change. In the case of The Elephant Man, now I don't think it's I think that it's best not to view it as some kind of social movement. It's just kind of an anomaly, like one horribly unfortunate man by no fault of his own, from a defect of his own birth, that he's put in this situation, and, you know, just showing him a bit of decency and, you know, trying to actually, you know, have him live somewhat of a decent life. I think that actually is ultimately a good thing overall. So I'm not going to be like this tough guy and say that he should just be like tossed into the canals or something like that. However, the problem is when that instinct that a lot of Europe that we have as Europeans, like we're the most empathetic people. That doesn't mean we don't have some real bastards among ourselves as well. But I think that, that when that's kept in check, it overall is a good thing. But you know, it just can't be put into the wrong ends as it is today.
I've seen a few people in the chat mention an older film called Freaks, which I doubt. I mean, I watched that years ago, and it's one of the most depressed. It's like, well, the reason why I bring that up is that I think there is a clear connection between the, I think it's Todd Brown who might have done it. I'm probably going to get corrected from that. But that was from the 1930s. And that's like a sideshow, freak show in America, though, kind of touring around. And the abnormalities in that are actually worse than in The Elephant Man. Well, firstly, I'll come back to that, because if you actually look at The Elephant Man, there were some photos taken of him as he really was, not in the film. He looks worse. He actually genuinely does look worse in as he really was than as David Lynch has put him. Yeah. There's something else as well that he's a bit nicer in this. Like in the real world, he was a bit more world-wise, and he actually signed contracts. I don't think he was like this slave. I don't think that would have been allowed in Victorian England, to be quite honest. I mean, people will push back on that when you think of the workhouses and stuff, but I actually think just somebody like running around, like, where's my man? I think you probably wouldn't get away with that in Victorian England.
No. One thing that I did read about today was that the authorities were actually trying to shut down a lot of these freak shows at the time.
Yeah.
And then also that in reality, John Merrick actually decided to join the freak show himself. So
yeah.
Now it is true that his manager did treat him like shit and actually robbed him when he was over in Europe, in Brussels, I think it was. And so, I mean, they did mistreat, he was mistreated, but it's not like he was a slave. So he actually did decide to get into that field. But So it wasn't like he was just kidnapped and then forced into it. But yeah.
So the original Freaks movie is, as I remember it, so bear with me because it's been years, and obviously it's a bit of an obscure film, but the freaks in that, they've got like where the back of their heads is tiny, but their faces are massive, and they're all they just look weird, and they were actual. I think they like in the American kind of deep south or whatever, they still had freak shows at that time, and so it looks real. Another thing they have are like people who are like without arms and legs, and the story as I remember it is that there's this blonde woman, and she's genuinely a horrible person, and I think she frames one of them for murder or something like that. But in the end, she is pretty. She is, you know, she is like a whole healthy, good looking woman, unlike everybody else in the freak show, obviously. And in the end, I remember she gets caught, and all the freaks team up against her, because it just traumatized me. And you see them all crawling towards her, and she's looking. I think she's like in a cage or in the corner of a tent. And then the next time you see her, she's got no hair anymore, and she's also got no arms and legs, and she's kind of like writhing around in this sort of, as if she's become an object. So she's been changed by being mutilated, to be quite honest, and she's moved from being a subject to an object. And whereas with The Elephant Man, it's the first sort of part of the film is this change from John Merrick as an object, and he's a person, a full-blown person, he's a subject. And so with a story and with feelings, and with her way, it goes completely the other way. And I found that absolutely horrific when I saw, I found it just so, there's almost like nihilistic in its view like that. But when Merrick is in Belgium, And it's he's going to escape from the freak show, and Bites is drunk and he's abusing him again. And Merrick is struggling because he keeps passing out on the stage, so it's costing him money. And you see the rest of the freaks in the show, though they're not nearly as bad. It's like it's the little midget who was in R2-D2, and it's him and a few others, and they set him free. But the shot of them approaching Merrick, so we see it as if we are John Merrick, and the shot is the exact same one from the Freaks movie. And knowing David Lynch, I'm sure he was very fond of that earlier movie. So that there is a clear sort of connection between the two films, which is kind of obscure to get into. But hey, that's what classic movies is all about. That's what we get into on here anyway.
So another aspect of the movie is, I think that it's interesting that it was set in the Victorian period, was of course that's when John Merrick actually was alive, because you know it was a period about discovery was a major theme of the Victorian era. So of course this is when Britain was expanding across the world, getting new territories, finding new species and everything like that, and you know this and the Western world more broadly. This was basically just as the world had been mapped and everything, and science. It was a scientific golden age. When you think of this era, there were like dozens of world changing inventions which were brought about in the late 19th century, and the figure of Frederick Treves, so Anthony Hopkins' character, he really does kind of embody that Victorian man. So he's this brilliant doctor and scientist, and he sees John Merrick as not as a freak, but as a problem to be solved medically, so scientifically. So he sees this man, he says, well, he has a very severe deformity, very severe medical illness, and that we need to study him. So it's rather than putting him in front of a freak show and jeering at him, well, we need to study him because we need to learn about this. We need to learn about this condition, and we need to advance the cause of medical science. And we can use this as an opportunity to advance the cause of medical science. So, you know, you think of the word progress today. So when you hear the word progressive, today that's just synonymous with libtardism. It just means that when someone's a progressive today, it just means that they want to turn everyone non-white and gay. But that's not what it meant in the late 19th century. So to be a progressive, like someone like this character would have been, it meant more like a progressing science and technology, and using the newfound knowledge to solve society's ills. So, you know, this could include things like the labor movement, which we talked about during the Christmas Carol stream. This included things like dealing with urbanization, natural conservation, healthcare, which is and medical science, which is the one on display here. And then there are other ones like things like eugenics, the prohibition movement, first wave feminism, the advent of the welfare state, things like that. These were the big kind of issues of the time. And somebody that would have been a progressive, or at least would have been called that at the time, they were into these issues, and they kind of wanted to utilize the newfound knowledge of the past century to solve the issues of the time. So this was just after the Industrial Revolution had been completed, and they now kind of saw this as this great opportunity to create this great new society. And you know, at the time, you must have thought, because I can imagine actually being very optimistic in those days because of all the technology that was being invented, all the advancement which was being made. The West was at its height. Britain was the most powerful country in the world. Not that I want to get too deep into that here, but with this worldview, I have some sympathy to it. But I also have some. I think there are also a lot of criticisms to be made, because this kind of worldview of treating society's problems as like it's a scientific issue, like using science to solve everything, that we can find a scientific conclusion. It was actually effective in some ways. So people actually did, the life expectancy increased. So towards the end of the Industrial Revolution, things like infant mortality went way down. Of course, they never had never had anything to cure John Merrick, but and I don't even think we'd have that today. But I think that the problem with the worldview is that it can't really deal with the questions that can't be answered scientifically. It has a very hard time dealing with the moral questions of the time. So and it kind of gets into what was alluded to in the film, where the character, where Anthony Hopkins' character Frederick Treves, he kind of viewed John Merrick as being this as being like a as an opportunity. So he was a lot kinder to him, but at the same time there was the accusation that, you know, was he doing the same thing, was by doing this medical display of him and studying him and putting him on doing all these like lectures about him, was that kind of their own kind of freak show. And you know, you see later in the movie, it's more the someone like John Merrick, with him, it's more the idealism which actually kind of gives his life meaning. So it's the idea that he actually can understand God, that he actually finds religion, that he learns to read poetry, and he learns to he goes to the opera house, and he becomes friends with people in high society, and he actually gains like an amount of idealism. And that's kind of a cure for him, not really a cure, but it's a way that he can live a non-miserable life that the scientific approach really that really couldn't do. So you see that, you can see with the character, with Anthony Hopkins' character, it shows the benefits of this worldview, but at the same time, it has its drawbacks, and that, you know, it can't really bring about the things which are more transcendental, which ultimately is what gives John Merrick something resembling a decent life.
Yeah, it's implied at the end, I think, after he dies, there's a couple of things happening, because just like towards what you were saying there as well, remember, he's building the model of the cathedral,
yes,
but he can't actually see the bottom of the cathedral, so he just uses his imagination as to what it's going to be like, but he can see the belfry and the tower and all of that. And then, so he goes to the opera, and he gets a standing ovation, and everybody's welcome him. You've made at home. I think he even sits next to the Princess of Wales. He gets a letter from Queen Victoria, so he's been very well taken care of. But then he goes home at the end, or to his little room, which is nice and clean, and he finishes his cathedral that he's been making, and then he whispers to himself, he kind of puts his hand on his head and says it's finished, and then you see him go over and pull all of the pillows off, and he's going to sleep straight down like a normal person for the first time in his life, knowing that this is going to kill him. But there's a couple of little throwaway lines as well from the nurses that he is dying. He knows, everybody knows, including himself, he won't have much longer. And then you get this typical kind of David Lynch dream sequence where he sees his mother again, and she says, nothing will die. And I think the idea is that it's this realization that he has a soul, and that he is transcending the material, because the material hasn't been particularly nice to him. So it's like, in the end, God has also granted you a soul, and now, you know, you will now transcend, you'll go to heaven, you will see your mother again, and you will leave this kind of horrible material sort of tomb that you've been in for, I think he was only like 23 or 24 or something. And so it's like, I mean, I can understand it from Lynch's point of view. How do you wrap this up without sending everybody home completely depressed? And I think that's where he went for. The actual sequence with his mother and that kind of halo around her going through space is almost identical to the one of the dream sequence in that Paul Atreides does in Dune, which would be made 4 years after this. So yeah, I think that's very well done. You don't walk away feeling too depressed, but it's not a very happy film at all. This at all. I mean, on the issue of progress, it does raise interesting questions, doesn't it? Because it's all very well, I like to kind of go against my usual sort of takes or others in this scene. There's an assumption that we're living in a worse time now than we were, say, 300 years ago. But the fact is, I don't want to see freak shows. Like, I'm happy that we don't have freak shows anymore. But maybe this is just because I'm a liberal, because without wanting to be, you know, we can complain about it, but maybe they were just born into a softer time. Because I can see people making defenses of religion that we had in the past that we don't have now, or like more of a warrior culture, or the fact that we were proud and we were strong and all this. But people don't want to defend things like freak shows. And then, like, I don't want us to have freak shows. I don't like them. And I like to think that if I was in Victorian London, I would have opposed them then. But does that make me like a libtard in waiting? Or because that can be brought up along with the funny thing is, like, lefties are kind of too demented that they don't actually go for that. They'll pick something like religion, which is, it doesn't work as well as that. But yeah, I'm not a fan of freak shows. Are you a fan of freak shows?
No, I'm not. I would probably find them quite disturbing. I don't know how I'd feel back then, but I wouldn't want to think of myself attending one of them. I guess just that, because I don't want to go too far out of the scope of the stream, my answer to liberals and leftists when they talk about progress is what I say as well. You know, I don't think the correct question is, are things better now than they were a century and a half in the past? The question should be, are things now as good as they could possibly be? Because it doesn't, I mean, in many ways, some things are better now. So, you know, medical science is a lot better. I don't want to go back to having if I have to go in for a surgery, I'd rather have the stuff we have now than have the stuff we had 200 years ago. So I don't want to, to answer the question of progress, what I always say is, you know, what are we living the best way we can today? And if not, well, then what needs to be changed? Because, you know, of course, there are some things which are better now than in the past. The difference is, though, that, like, there are things that are bad today and because they are being made that way, which weren't so in the past. And the answer is we just need to correct that mistake. And that doesn't mean going back. What that means is correcting a wrong and then going forward with that correction now being made. And you can apply that to many of the issues which we always talk about. You know, with the freak show, I also wonder, though, because we talked about this a bit before, has this thing really gone away? Because I wonder, did the freak show die with the advancement of scientific knowledge and of medical science? Because the idea, like, because you can imagine somebody in the 19th century seeing someone like John Merrick and just thinking of that as something as absolutely demonic. So, you know, upper, as you see in the movie now, by this point, high society, the educated classes now saw this through a scientific lens, whereas the plebs still kind of saw it as this kind of horrifying, like, a freak of nature to be either jeered at, to be fascinated by, or to just scream at. But you can imagine, like, let's say someone like that appeared in medieval Europe. Let's say, like, this was in the 11th century. People would scream, and not only that, they would probably think that this thing, that this individual, as we now know today, that it was some kind of medical disorder. They would probably think that this was something demonic. They would think that this was this ungodly creature or something like that. And yeah. I will say what I said earlier, that I don't feel like. I do feel like there is a healthy instinct in feeling by fearing and distrusting that which is out of the ordinary. Of course, you know, it would be kind of cruel, as you see in the case of John Merrick. But I wonder, though, that since today we now know that things like people who would have been in a freak show in centuries past, we now know that it's just a medical disorder. It's not like this demonic thing. It's not this. It's kind of been demystified. So it's been demystified in a way that we kind of can understand it, even though, of course, I don't understand it. I'm not a doctor or anything, but I understand that there is an explanation for it out there and that somebody does understand it and they could explain it. And that kind of demystifies the thing of the freak show. But then when you think of today, we don't have these traveling shows anymore where they display people with with physical, biological abnormalities. But think about things like the Jerry Springer show. I mean, is that not a freak show? I mean, is that not the exact same thing behind that? Did the Jerry Springer show not have the exact same thing behind it, which the freak shows did a century earlier? You know, bringing these dysfunctional, horrible, antisocial people onto TV and then having a crowd like jeer at them and be shocked by them and get outraged and everything like that. And yes, for anyone who's going to write this in the chat, I know what Jerry Springer's ethnic background was. My point is, though, is this not kind of the same thing? Do we not still just have this morbid fascination with things which are either disgusting or disturbing or grisly? Like, how many people, how many videos out there are there documenting every single aspect of Ted Bundy's life or something like that? How many books are there, documentaries about serial killers? It's like an entire subgenre at this point. Like, Ted Bundy himself is an entire subgenre. Or then you can look at something a bit more recent, like things like on TikTok these days, like there was that influencer from a few weeks ago. I obviously didn't follow the story, but it found its way onto my timeline somehow. I didn't search it out, but there was that woman who slept with 100 men in one day. Well, I mean, it's a horrible thing to imagine, but this garnered millions and millions of views on the internet. Is it not the same thing that behind this, which was behind the freak shows in centuries past?
I mean, I actually think it's worse, because at least John Merrick was just ugly. But it's kind of weird, because it's kind of like we've come full circle. And you can say, if what that girl that sleeps with like 100 men in a day or 1,000 or whatever it is, like, yeah, maybe our freak show is just the internet. And you think you come all the way back to maybe most people are just scum. Like, I realize it's this like horrible thing, but maybe, or if not most, then a huge chunk of society, like, maybe they need the stern leadership that they had in the Victorian era, because otherwise their sense of morals will just go all to hell. Because it seems to me that we live like the freak show didn't go away, it just became more sophisticated and all-encompassing. And even then, like, think of the idea of you scroll on Twitter. I saw a photograph yesterday. I didn't see a video, but there was something going around, and it was a woman in the war with Russia and Ukraine. Now, I don't know what side she was on, and I don't know who did this, but what was going around was that she was begging. There was a drone coming towards her, and apparently she was begging for the drone to go away. She was begging the controllers not to, and they didn't. They hovered the drone above this woman who presumably had been conscripted or what. I don't know. I don't know what the backstory is, and I don't know what side she was fighting for. I'm not making a judgment either way. Just leave all that aside. It's just this idea that we can sit and watch a woman begging for her life, and then the man or whoever is controlling the drone flies it into her anyway and blows her half to pieces, and then she begins crawling across the ground, writhing around, and then they send in another one and finish her off. Now, that's grotesque. You can say it's war, whatever. The issue that we're talking about here is the freak show as the kind of society of the spectacle, society of finding amusement in these grotesqueries, because none of us are actually in that war zone or in that situation, and we get to kind of sit there and like or retweet something as horrible as that. We get to sit there with a cup of tea and sort of scroll past it as if maybe you don't care. Maybe you're bored with it. Maybe you've seen enough of the war footage. Maybe you want to have a hot take about women going in the army, or they wanted equality, it's their fault, whatever. The fact is, by that imagery existing in the first place, you're partaking in the freak show. whatever your view, like the freak show is, if you're on the internet, almost impossible to escape from. Because when we say the freak show, it's not about just ugly people. It's the demonic and the grotesque and the abnormal being consumed. But with the internet, that's done up to scale. It's not just some back street in some crappy part of London where you've got a bearded woman or a man who looks like a bear. What was it? There's a man who looks like a lion. You know what I mean? But that's one thing. But it's quite something else when you literally just flick open your phone and you're confronted with this stuff. That to me is the true nature of social media, of the internet, is just one giant freak show, and nobody's changed. We can look down our noses at people in Victorian England who went to see the Lion Man or threw a cabbage at John Merrick. All right, disgusting behavior. Is that not just the internet though? Except they do it from the safety of their homes. It seems to me the freak show is here, bigger and better and stronger than ever.
I mean, one thing you mentioned is that you don't get a choice. You're already watching the freak show just by being on the internet. I mean, that story about that woman who had slept with 100 men, I didn't search that out. I didn't look for it. I had never heard of this person before. I don't even remember her name. I didn't comment on it or anything. It found me, and it made sure that it found me. And it wasn't just the online right that was sharing it with me. It was with other things, like other apolitical channels, which I follow. Some things which are totally unrelated to all this online politics. They were talking about this too. And it's just like, I was trying, it's a horrible thing. And I was just trying to avoid this story, but it just, it was just like, it was following me around the internet for a couple of weeks. And, you know, it's a horrible thing, but you just can't avoid it. And you also just have to remember that how many of these videos just have millions and millions and millions of views. So you can make a video on, I don't want to attack the audience or anything like that. But one thing I have noticed is that a video on something which is kind of positive is always going to get less views than a video that's on something negative. So if I do something on some book from the 19th century, which I liked, or, you know, I'll do something about Canadian history and about this piece of land in Canada. And, you know, what happened here in the 18th century? Well, that's going to pay the views that thing actually gets. It's going to pale in comparison to the views that a video on, oh, well, look at this mass murder which just happened. And look at how the media is covering it up and how there's this guy, it turns out, oh, it's this Muslim again. And, you know, I don't say this to attack the audience, but it does feel like people do. And I'm not saying this is exclusive to the online right either.
You can see it in the viewing figures for these streams. You can see it in the viewing figures for the classic movie streams, where this has got like 273 views. Because it's a 45-year-old movie that's black and white, and it seems a bit depressing. But look, we've done all kinds of films, and they're not all doom and gloom. We've done some quite light-hearted ones. But people want, at the end of the day, people want the slop, what is now called the slop. And if I was to end this stream and fire up another stream and call it, let's say, Southport Apocalypse, and I will do like an hour-long deep dive into what's been going on this week in England, and with the horrors there, and I could read through the court reports and all the rest of it. Yeah, I would get a lot of views, I should think. I mean, I get punished by YouTube because my standard format is a video essay of like 20 minutes long, not a live stream. So YouTube doesn't like me doing live streams, but whatever. The point still stands that, yeah, I could do like Southport Apocalypse. I could have a picture of that Axel Rudacabana, whatever he is, that horrible sort of demonic thing which has been going around. And it would get a load of views, an absolute load of views. But it would be teetering on just engaging in sort of the slop. It would be just dipping into the freak show. especially when you put it that face on the front of it. Literally having the face of the demon, the grotesque and the macabre, knowing what he's done. Yes, it's all the freak show. The freak show is bigger and stronger and more all-pervasive than ever before. And love it.
And I'm not saying this to attack, the online right or our kind of sphere of the internet. And hey, the people who are watching the stream, you're the guys who are the ones who are not tuning into the outrage porn. You're the ones who are tuning into the. This stream's not exactly a positive one, but Classic Movies is usually quite lighthearted. So thanks for everyone for tuning in. But one thing you'll also see is with all these other channels is that what the videos which get the most views are the ones where it's like a video about another YouTuber or something like that about how, oh, this person exposed this guy. Yeah. He was a great YouTuber 5 years ago, but now he's not paying the staff, which he hired, which he could only hire because of the viewers. And he's a piece of shit and he lost his house. And you can think about any kind of interest group, any kind of, niche on YouTube, whether it's gaming, whether it's it's also true with the politics stuff, whether it's about movies or anything like that. Maybe even women have something for these cosmetic channels. Maybe they have their own drama videos, but those drama videos always get more views because everyone loves to see the downfall of some e-celeb because the internet is the freak show now.
Yeah, and it dominates everything. I mean, it is what it is. I try and add a little bit of nuance to my content, and sometimes it is. Sometimes you want to just have a rant. Sometimes you want to do, a thousand word just getting things off your chest. It's worth it. But the fact is, it's become like an industry. It's industrial weight sort of. Slop content. To get back to that woman, that girl in the war who was blown up by a drone despite begging for her life. I think that there's going to be a little part of your soul that just sort of leeches away every time you see something like that, it seems to me. And it's the same as when you see the kind of, it touches on the core issue of the Elephant Man. Because what they're saying is, what is it to be human? And the socialites in London are faced with a choice. What do we do with this extreme abnormal situation? And they've decided to try and live with it and to normalize it, which has its own, as we discussed, long-term ramifications. But it's not to just consume it as entertainment. There's something in that with the exhibition. I mean, Joy Division had a song. I meant to look up what they meant because I have a feeling that Ian Curtis might have been alluding to something like this, but it was called Atrocity Exhibition. And so that really is, it's strange because we haven't actually gone off on a tangent yet. This is like crucial to what the Elephant Man is all about. It's all about looking and being looked at and the show and the exhibition of the macabre. And it's, what does that say about you? Because if your boon, as they say in the chat there, or you're that fella with the two prostitutes who's come from the pub, and you're laughing and you're pouring whiskey down John Merrick's throat or all of this. Like, yeah, it's David Lynch's commentary, not so much on the working class, but on the mass, on the crowd, the dumb sort of vindictive herd. And this is why it's kind of strange that he's got all of this industrial aesthetics in the movie as well. I mean, this is throughout, along with all of the long corridors. But where it really hits home is that time and again, it's this this ambience of the Industrial Revolution. It's steam, it's cool, it's the gas fires that people have got in their houses, like the little ones coming out from the walls. And then when you see Merrick coming back from Belgium and he's on the steam train, it's obviously lingering on the steam coming out of the train. And then when he arrives in London, in the train station in London, and he's running through trying to get away from the kids who are taunting him, and he comes up against this cage. There's part of the platform, part of the station has been locked off, and he comes up against this rusty iron grating sort of, and it looks like a cage. And you get this again and again and again with Merrick being caged, like a caged animal, or on stage, or caged and on a stage. And it will, because Lynch's filmmaking is so intelligent and so great, you get these little symbols in it of what he's trying to get at there. And remember, the cage in the station is also a product of the Industrial Revolution. It's rusty and it's harsh and it's really tough, and there's it's nothing organic or natural about it. And I think one of the sort of subtexts, what he's getting at here, is the effect of mass and scale industrialization on the masses themselves. It's almost like they're nothing different than a pile of coal. Or, you know, the quantity, they are now just a mass of units in this industrialized sort of fabric and wasteland of Victorian England. Whereas the elites, of course, are sitting there in their refinery and then they're listening to Mozart and all of this kind of thing. And it's as if in the end, the effect of all of this has had on the masses to not so much dehumanize the freaks and the outliers, but the masses themselves have become something almost subhuman, because this is the world that they now inhabit. I love those kinds of gloomy but very cerebral meditations on these things. So yeah, I mean, it's when you think of it. On the face of it, The Elephant Man, it doesn't seem to have that much to discuss, but it does, because it teases you out and all these kind of dilemmas. Like, what is it? Like, what is the stance of a reactionary on freak shows? If you're going to celebrate the past, do you celebrate it all, warts and all, as Cromwell said? Or do you kind of admit that the progressives and the direction of society is improved and all of this kind of thing. So anyway, have you got any parting shots?
Well, I guess the movie, I would say, you know, it's kind of a downer. It's definitely not the most uplifting movie, and it's extremely hard with this subject matter to actually have any kind of positive feeling, because you really do feel horrible for John Merrick. And you feel especially more horrible knowing that there actually was a real man and he actually had to live that life. But I guess the positive to take out of it is that the thing that I guess I would say was kind of admirable about John Merrick, or Joseph Merrick as his real name was, is that he actually was able to find some idealism despite, you know, his most wretched state of existence. So the real John Merrick, he became a Christian. He was a very devout believer. He actually did build that cathedral. So I actually think he built more than one kind of model like that. So the model that he's building in the movie, he actually did build that, and it still does exist today. He got into poetry. Allegedly, he was a really good writer. And I mean, I don't know if the guy was necessarily a genius per se. But, you know, he actually did kind of find a way to live. Of course, you know, it was only made possible because the upper classes of the time decided to actually to make it possible for him. But, you know, he actually lived a decent life. So about that trip to the opera, he actually did go see an opera. I don't know if he got a standing ovation. I don't know if that actually happened, but he actually did go to see a performance like that. And apparently, from what I heard, he was talking about it for days and days and long after that, because, you know, he's someone who obviously lived a very miserable life, and he himself isn't beautiful at all. I don't mean to imply that, you know, John Merrick is beautiful. He's obviously hideous, but he actually still kind of understood the concept. And I guess it's finding that idealism in the worst kind of existence. I'd say that's what's really admirable about John Merrick. If you can take anything positive away from the movie, it would be that. But yeah, you know, it's an interesting drama, and it brings up some really heavy moral questions, which I had to square with my own beliefs, because I feel a lot of empathy for him, but at the same time I'm weary of how the downsides of empathy based on the modern world. So definitely worth a watch. I'd heard about it years ago, but this was the first time I got around to actually watching it.
Virtue has an interesting one in the chat there, and he says his anti-organic themes and Elephant Man are intriguing because this film is set in Britain. He does not really repeat the theme for and in the USA. Yeah, that's true. The way that Lynch films America, and I'm thinking of Blue Velvet, although that has dark scenes in it, but especially Twin Peaks and Straight Story, he clearly loves Americana and Middle America. It gets and tellingly, interestingly, things get very dark in Mulholland Drive, which is set entirely in Hollywood, I think it is. So he clearly has a bias towards small town America. He loves it, the way that he films it, he loves it. And the industrial sort of anti-organic, he does that in Eraserhead, which is even more hardcore than Elephant Man, in the way that he does that with the baby that comes out and it looks like a little reptile, and it's sort of all of it is in this kind of grotty, in almost like post-industrial kind of grime, and everything's rusted and harsh, and it's just horrible. And then also interestingly in June for the Harkonnens, you see this kind of heavy industrialized aesthetic comes back to represent the Harkonnens again in the Lynch June, which is completely at odds with the Atreides, which is more regal and all of that. It looks more like the elites in Elephant Man, but from an earlier era. Correct to the book as well. To be fair, the Harkonnens are like on an industrialized wasteland in the book. So it's great. It's great to do films which really make you think. It's good. It's good. So Henrietta and the £3 super sticker. Thank you very much. I don't think I've ever had one of them before. And then there's another super chat by Orklo Rocks. Long time fan. I know the name. Regarding being for €20. So thank you very much for that. Regarding being afraid, not wanting to look at a freak show because you might feel you are outing yourself as a progressive, this is yet another battle we have to fight to show the right embodies decency as a core value. Yeah, I would completely agree with that as well. I mean, this is something that the left kind of, they pretend that they are just good people. You can see, you've got sort of Trump trying to roll back all of these woke policies and whatnot in America. And they're trying to sort of put it as if, well, he's outlawing niceness or something. You know, the Mott and Bailey thing, where when they're in power, it's all about just banning everybody and hating white people, white privilege, and riots and all of this, pulling down the statues and everything. And then when somebody comes in we're not going to get into that on this stream, but let's just assume he's going to rule some of this back, hopefully. Then all of a sudden it's like, oh, what? You just hate equality. You just hate, we are nice people. You know, we can't be bad people. We are nice people. It's just being nice. We just had it into law that you had to be nice to trans people and all of this kind of thing. It's just utterly hollow. And we in Britain, everybody knows the media, right? We don't even get that much of the heavy ideology. We just get state power and lies. It's just lies and state power. That's what we get in that version.
Yeah, I guess to answer the guy's question, first of all, to go off of what you were saying, that, you know, they're kind of like the left tries to portray themselves as nice. I do feel that is really wearing off, and I think they've really kind of lost that moral high ground. But anyway, to answer the guy's question, I think that is an important point that he brings up, because I don't think it makes you a libtard to say that you don't want to go see a freak show, because I mean, I do know that there were aristocrats who were fascinated by things which were weird, and a lot of them made it their pet projects. So someone like Peter the Great did something like this. Like, he collected all these like strange anomalies. And I know that it's common for European monarchs to have things like midgets in their courts, you know, as like some kind of entertainment. So it's not like saying the aristocracy was above being fascinated by things which were weird. But, you know, would an aristocratic person like pay like a penny to go see some guy in a back alley who, you know, has like hair covering his entire face or something like that? You know, I do think that, you know, you can see some things as just kind of being beneath you because you don't view them as decent. And even though people did them in the past, well, that doesn't mean that, you know, it was decent when people did that back then either. So I don't think that, you know, being against the existence of things like a freak show makes you a libtard.
No, and the problem is, like, common decency is something which is difficult to quantify. And when you get into the outer edges of it, whereas, so a lot of what the sort of the shit lib does is to say everything is just a matter of common decency, even though it ends up where you've got like mass murders and just outright barbarism on the streets. And they will then try and sort of write that off as being an extreme outlier. But the problem is, it's becoming increasingly normal and everybody sees it. So then you just get lies and this, all this ridiculous sort of reframing and nudging, and it's terrible. It's just so dishonest and so demoralizing. But all right, so there's just another one come in there. Travis Happy for $5. Thank you very much. Have you got any idea what we're going to be doing next month?
I think we might go with the 300 Spartans.
All right, that sounds good. Are we going to do a compare and contrast, or just do what one the?
Oh, I'll think about that. Yeah, people can write in the chat whether they'd like to see us cover both the Zack Snyder movie from 2007 and the 1960s one, or whether one of them would suffice, because it is kind of the same story. It's shot very differently. It's in a bit of a different style, but, you know, it is ultimately the same story. So I'll think about whether I want to do a compare and contrast between the two or just the one film. But we'll definitely be doing the 1960s one, but maybe adding I'll think about adding the double feature.
All right. So thank you very much, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the stream, and we will see you next month on Endeavor's channel for a new classic movies. Good night now.